Welcome to a special bonus episode of Good Food on KCRW. The Food Book Fair recently came to downtown Los Angeles from March 2nd through the 4th. It's an incredible event featuring some of the brightest minds in food media. And so we wanted to share this bonus episode featuring a couple highlights from the fair, which took place at the Ace Hotel. This is the first episode of a two-part series. Next Monday, you can listen to the second part. First up is a super great panel that I got to be on about the future of food media. This conversation has been edited for length.
Good morning, Los Angeles. Just wanted to say a quick hello. I'm Amanda Dell from Food Book Fair.
I'm Kimberly Chow. We are the co-directors of Food Book Fair, an annual, now biannual and bi-coastal festival all about writing about eating and talking about it. And we're really excited to be doing this with our partners at Ace Hotel downtown LA and with Life and Time. We have a really exciting conversation all about the landscape, an ever-evolving landscape of food and media.
So now, really without further ado, we will turn it over to Antonio Diaz, the founder of Life and Time.
Hey, guys. So real quick, Over Coffee is this monthly series that we started a few months ago in Highland Park, and now we're taking it under the umbrella of Ace Hotel. And basically, we're trying to make sense of the world with coffee and conversations. Every month, we invite a panel of experts within a specific theme and topic, and we dive into it, and we talk about it, and you drink coffee. So easy peasy. So today's session is something that is very dear to me because I'm also in the media business, and it's my life. And selfishly, I wanted to do this session just to learn from these amazing people that we have up here. Juan Davis, who is the chief creative officer at KCT, and he's also the executive producer of The Myron Kitchen, which Life and Time produces and directs on KCT. So give a round of applause to Juan Davis. And then we have Evan Kleiman, the James Beard Award winner, author, and host of KCRW's Good Food. If you're in LA and you're in food, you know who she is. And I was actually just listening to her on the right over here. So, Evan Kleiman, thank you. And then we're also joined with Claudia Wu, co-founder and creative director of Cherry Bomb Magazine, which celebrates women and food in the food industry. So we're just going to dive in because we have a lot to talk about, and I'm like just ready to dig into this. So to start things off, each of you have been tackling journalism in unique ways, from documentary to radio to print. I'm curious, where did the love of journalism stem from, and where were you able to kind of cut your teeth in the world of journalism or media?
Am I the default beginner?
I think you are.
For me, it was a very ad hoc situation. I was a chef. I had a restaurant. And I was an occasional guest on Good Food, which had been airing, I think, for just a little bit over a year. Mary Sue and Susan, who own Border Grill, were the hosts. And I would come on, and I would be the garden-to-table person and the Jewish holiday person. And one day I was contacted by Jennifer Farrow, who at that point was Ruth Seymour's assistant, and she was the executive producer of the show, and she said, how would you like to be the host of Good Food? Mary Sue and Susan need to step away, and I was like, I have no idea. But I said yes, and I think it didn't really occur to me that I was a journalist maybe till 8 years later. I mean, for me, it was just all about knowledge. And back in the ancient times, we acquired knowledge through reading books and having conversations over the telephone with people. So it was this very slow accretion of information. And I realized that the show would allow me to feed what the restaurant didn't feed, which was my intellectual interest in food, which had always been there since I was a kid. And it has done that, continues to do that.
I loved magazines when I was growing up, and I collected them avidly. And my parents' house is still full of all these magazines that I'm trying to go through and throw out, but I can't part with. I guess I come from it from the other side, from the creative side. I studied graphic design, and my first job out of college was at a magazine. And I've just kind of worked at a bunch of places ever since. And I actually launched another magazine before Cherry Bomb called Me Magazine that was kind of like my own thing. It was very, very indie, so indie. But yeah, I love print. I love the process of putting a magazine together. It's like a puzzle. And in the end, it comes out, and you're just like, yeah, that's what it was meant to be. Like, this is the whole picture. But I do have to say, once I started working in magazines, I do not buy magazines anymore. I don't know what it is. I think the magic or the mystery is taken out of the process, and I know how it's put together, and I just like doing it now. I don't really like consuming them so much.
That's really interesting.
I guess I came to journalism out of, it was sort of a turn in my career. I came here to LA to, you know, to write fiction and direct fiction. And that didn't work out very well. While I was trying that, I'm originally from Colombia, and I went to Colombia to do a documentary of the first case of AIDS. And it was a friend of mine that I had met here, and his brother had been going through that. And that really opened a completely different door to telling stories. And then when it came to food, I've been at KCT for a while, probably, you know, 10 years. And, you know, we're you know, lifestyle for television, especially for public television, is a little difficult to convince people and, you know, to raise money to do it. But, you know, there were so many things going on, changing in our demographics and stuff like that. And I knew that there was a way that we could talk about a lot of issues that were, you know, part of our society through food. And I really wanted to have a food show that would be able to communicate all that. On top of that, you know, when I was around 16 years old, I think, my dad, who is now deceased, he died many years ago, maybe 35 years ago, but he was a painter, visual artist, and he had an exhibit in Brussels. And he took me there. I don't know why I'm telling you guys this, but I'm gonna share it. And you know, we were in the plaza of Brussels. I don't know who has been there, which is beautiful. And he told me, "Do you want to have a beer?" And they served me a Chimay, and I had a Chimay, and that's a very high alcohol beer. And I had another one. And I looked at my dad, and I looked around, and I was like, this is the best moment in my life. And now every time that I drink a Chimay, I go back to that. So capturing also those memories, you know.
Hi, Facebook.
Yeah.
Juan, so in your case, you know, you and your team are actively searching for talent, whether they're documentarians or writers. You know, I was very fortunate to be taken under your wing to develop the Myron Kitchen and steer us in, you know, the right direction as far as story narratives and themes. What is it that you look for in people? In people when you're working with them, hiring them, whether they're fresh in the documentary world, or what do you look for in ideas for shows?
Well, this is the thing. I think I know a bunch of stuff about how to tell a story. But there's the formal aspects of it, right? But then there's the content. There's the, you know, the what is this thing about? And you know, there are people that are so much better equipped to holding that knowledge, be it food or, you know, immigration or other things. And I, one of the things that I love is to be able to partner with people that are more, that are smarter than I am in those content areas. And I can bring to the table with the team that we have assembled, you know, a knowledge about framework and format and all these sort of things. But that dialogue between people like you that have been living and have been embedded in a particular subject matter, you know, married with what we know from broadcast and digital media and things like that, you know, it's the greatest thing. You know, I don't know about you guys, but for me, I do what I do because I love to learn, and I love to learn from other people. And that sense of discovery needs to be part of everything that we do. And it can be on a food show like Migrant Kitchen, or it can be a history show about Los Angeles history, or it can be an art show or whatever it is that sense of discovery that we are discovering and we're coming up with ideas and ways to communicate it. Yeah.
Claudia, what about for Cherry Bomb? You know, the magazine has built a specific voice for the past couple of years, and it's become unique and has long championed women way before the Me Too movement. How do you cultivate that mission with the people that you work with writers, and also the people that you're covering?
I think we've been really lucky because our mission was so specific, women and food, that a lot of people that come to us already have ideas. Like I remember the first issue, it was actually supposed to be a magazine for a restaurant, like an annual magazine. And then just through the process of talking to people and getting pitches from writers and stuff, everyone was like, oh, you should write about this woman, like, because no one else will ever write for her. You know, like, an editor at Bon App was like, Bon App will never write about her. You guys need to do it. So I think our kind of mission was shaped also by the people that contributed to the first issue. And it became something that we just thought the world maybe was missing in the world a little bit. And luckily, 6 years later, I'm glad a lot of people have agreed with us because we're still here. But it's been a strange journey, I have to say.
May I ask a question?
Please.
Sorry. How hard is it to still be here?
It's really hard. I think in life, you tend to just see the surface of things, and everything looks great, right? Everything, like, we seem to be doing well. We're doing conferences and all this stuff. But day to day, it's really tough. And financially, it's really hard to do a magazine without some sort of someone without deep pockets. We've never taken on any kind of investor, which I think we need to start doing because it is 6 years later. You know, we honestly, like, my co-founder and I only started paying ourselves in January. So I've been doing this for 5-6 years for nothing, you know, just because I love it and because I'm passionate about it. And because it gives me purpose in life, you know, I hate to say it, but money isn't everything to me. But in order to run a company, you need money. So, like, we've had a lot of sacrifices to keep it going.
In light of, you know, the Food Book Fair, which are primarily a lot of publishers, a lot of new voices entering the game, lots of, you know, issue one magazine publishers, and, you know, I share a very similar sentiment as you do because we had a print magazine for 6 issues quarterly. And for us, it was never our future. It was a strategic move temporarily. It was a way to validate ourselves from in the industry, from blog to publication. And that was a big deal for us. But it's also incredibly difficult and expensive, and distribution is stuck in the Stone Ages. So it would have bankrupted us, right? So now that you are able to at least, like, partially pay yourself and your team, do you think we're also living in some sort of bubble with indie magazines? Because print has been in a very fickle manner for a long time and is just fading away. But within that sort of disarray, there was the rise of indie magazines and very niche demographics and communities. And a lot of them became successful. So do you think that is sustainable? And are we going to see more magazines, you know, coming to fruition? Because now there's a lot of voices as well, lots of noise. A few of them are actually surviving past issue one, issue two, maybe issue three.
I think it's a similar mindset to starting a magazine as opening a restaurant. It's such a romantic idea, right? You're just like, I'm just going to open the doors and people will come and I'll feed them and they'll give me money. You know, it's the same thing with doing a magazine. In my previous magazine, it had its audience. And every time someone wanted to start a magazine in New York, they'd be like, oh, talk to Claudia. And my question to them would be like, why? What is your motivation for doing this? Because if you're not 100% behind it, you're going to get your heart broken. You know, it's not as cool as you think it is in reality. But I also want to make it clear that we pay all our employees. We just didn't take a salary. The founders just didn't take a salary. So we are making money, as opposed to my previous magazine, which was much more indie, and I funded it through working at ad agencies and other places. So, I mean, Cherry Bomb is a little bit different in the sense that it has a wider reach. It is kind of a real business now. I don't think the romance of print is going to go away so quickly, but it's the kind of thing where once you start it, you realize that you can't stop, right? You've committed, like, you're going to be quarterly. In your case, luckily, you said it was temporary. So you did six issues, but it's always a risk. It's always something that you either have to be 100% behind it yourself, or it's not going to last. Because that initial excitement and drive is going to fade once you realize how hard it is to keep going.
I can't tell you how disturbing, really distressing it is to hear the demise of print, the sentence being used as a throwaway line, because it doesn't really matter what media it is. Everything is writing. And the difficulty of institutional periodicals that are not only places for news, they were places for mentorship and for people to learn a craft. So to work at a newspaper or a large magazine where you know you're going to be working there for 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, as a young person, you're going to get paid so you can live some kind of life, and you're going to learn in a way that you don't learn when you're at college. You're going to actually learn your trade. The fact that the institutional collapse for me in writing is the collapse of mentorship, which is now going the way of jobs. I mean, most people don't think about, people think about working, like they'll work one job and then another job and then another job, but there's not this sense of longevity that has inherent commitment to craft and to knowledge. And that cannot die, because that's just horrific. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and she said, count how many people in LA have full-time jobs writing about food.
And can we see a hand raise if you have a full-time job?
Not in PR. Not in PR. Full-time writing job about food.
One. We got one.
We figured that there were, we figured maybe there are 10 people in LA, 10 to 15 people in LA, you know, who have full-time jobs writing about food. And this is supposed to be like one of the most exciting food cities in the world right now. And if we can't support that, it's just, I don't know what to say. It's so awful.
It is. And I kind of want to like dig further into that idea, because news, media, journalism across the board, not just in food, has been in, you know, disarray more than ever. You know, from fake news to fickle advertising budgets to layoffs and corporate takeovers. On the food media side, you know, it hasn't been a bright meringue either. And, you know, we lost people like Lucky Peach. Saver laid off many of its employees, including its editor-in-chief. Vox Media laid off more than 50 people from its online video department. So that's not even... That's kind of crazy. I mean, we thought there was going to be this huge pivot to video. So even video is being scrutinized and diminished. And, you know, on the local front, LES was shuttered, but might be coming back in some way. LA Weekly is not sure what that is anymore. So no media LA is bulletproof. So I'm curious, what are some values and strategies that can keep a media outlet fruitful financially or editorially that we could at least look to and harness, even though there's no right answer?
Well, I have sort of personally gone through been part of experiencing the dramatic changes in public media, right? In public television. We split from PBS 6-7 years ago. Everybody thought that it was going to be the end of KCET, and it has not been the end of KCET. And I think that, you know, there are a couple of things that have really resurrected us in the last couple of years, in maybe 7 years. One was the use of just the digital space. How do you... use the digital space to incubate ideas? How to use the digital space to have two-way street communication with your communities and the communities that you're telling stories about or that you're trying to engage with. And, you know, that was back 7 years ago when... You know, algorithms were completely different than what they are right now. And, you know, there was still a sense of, you know, the social space as, you know, the there was a little bit more of freedom than what you have right now with, you know, ads and everything that they have done lately. That's one thing. Then the other thing was, you know, when we were part of PBS, there was this need to make these bigger gestures, right? That you need to... you know, tell these huge stories that are all encompassing. And the fact is, and I think that this may be with maybe the question that you were asking before, is that, you know, demographics are changing. And there is no longer this concept of, like, a narrative. There are thousands of them. And, you know, as long as you're able to try to talk about multiple narratives at the same time and have them coexist together, then I think that you're sort of charting a path, and that's ultimately what allowed us to succeed, because, you know, we no longer have $3-4 million budgets to make shows. We have, you know, what we would produce for $2 million 10 years ago, we produce for 400,000. And, you know, and that has really forced us to sort of reinvent how we do things, how we collaborate and partner, and how we engage communities.
What I find really interesting is I'm simultaneously a producer of content, but I'm also a huge consumer of content. And, I mean, I spend hours every week reading and watching. And it's overwhelming now. It used to be like 10 years ago, up to like 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I could actually say that I was capable of reading everything of a certain level of quality that was pertinent to my focus. Everything. Now it's like a nightmare. I mean... You know, I use my Twitter feed as a reading curator, and it's just, it's overwhelming. So on one level, there's such an astounding amount of stories out there, really interesting, engaging, well-written stories. But on another level, the fact that so many of them are created in a very super niche focused way scares me because I worry about mentorship. I worry about how people are surviving. And I also worry about the need for somebody to tell bigger stories.
You know, it's interesting. You know, for us, it has been all about experimentation. There has never been, like, the right answer. And 7 years ago, we, you know, there was this blogging mania. Everybody had a freaking blog. And KCT's website, we had over 800 blogs. I mean, it was crazy. And, you know, and we had all these page views, and it was amazing. And people were like, oh, my God. The quality was all over the place. The intention behind the stories was all over the place.
See, that's where podcasting is now, I think.
Yeah. And then at a certain point, and we had, you know, we hired, you know, all these contributors and things, and it was all very exciting. And then, you know, we did an audit, really, of quality versus quantity. And, you know, and we realize, holy shit, this is like 80% of the content that we're putting out there first has no real relevance. It's just chasing for a page view. And second, it's not really supporting the core values of what we are trying to communicate. And in the last 2 years, we have basically disseminated all that in the effort and in the need to really focus on these 10 or 15 things that we're really going to talk about.
Editing.
Yeah.
Editors. People who know how to edit and be editors and edit other people's work are just the key.
That's part of the reason why Cherry Bomb is still just a print magazine, because we know once you go off into the digital world, you are going to be chasing page views for dollars. But since we can restrict it to a print magazine, we can spend the time that we need to. We can, you know, cultivate the talent that we need to. We can do all these things and hopefully produce something that people will want to buy. You know, I love the web. I'm on the web every day. But you don't always, you're not required to pay for stuff. And you know that a lot of work goes into some of the stuff that happens. But we're just so used to not paying for anything that I think for us, having a product that you need to buy has kind of protected us in a little bit of, from this kind of like rat race.
Yeah, we tried things like, I think 7-6 years ago, we launched a show called Artbound. And the premise of the show was we're going to have blogs all over Southern California talking about arts and culture. And we're going to see which one is the most popular. And the most popular is going to be put against an editor's choice, and people are going to vote for those stories. Whichever story gets the most votes is going to be turned into a short documentary. Every 2 weeks, we would repeat that process, and we would make a one-hour show for broadcast. And back then, it was just amazing. You know, it energized a lot of people. But year by year, we started to notice how ineffectual it actually was, both editorially and one, and then two, editorially in the sense that you could not really go deep enough, one, and two, this idea of community engagement was really a rat race for popularity rather than anything else. So the likes and all this stuff was, people did not even read articles, or, you know, they just voted because the friend of a friend of a friend is posting somewhere, and, you know, and we stopped it. It was really effective for a couple of years, and then we stopped it. And I think that that's the other thing that you need to do is, you know that you can begin something, experiment, but it does not have to be the law, that the editorial law that you put down.
I want to talk about podcasts real quick since you mentioned it, Evan. So Apple has begun releasing analytics for podcast publishers.
Oh, really? Because we don't have any analytics. It's so bizarre. No, because Apple doesn't release. If Apple is the releaser of your podcast, Apple has not previously released analytics.
So it's...
It does not for our video.
Yeah. So they have slowly begun with a beta test. But you're free to email hi@apple.com and see if you get a response. But
maybe I don't want to know.
networks like Panoply said that listeners are making it through about 90% of the episodes, which is
extraordinary.
Yeah. And Midroll Media, which handles a lot of advertising for podcasting, they also said 90%, which is great. But we're sort of in this sort of rush of content when it comes to podcasting.
Well, I think it's like what blogs were. I mean, there's no barrier to entry now with the technology. You can just have an interest and be really passionate about it, and you can get a mic, and you can sit down and talk in front of a microphone. I cannot, you know, editing. Not everyone, including me, oh my God, if I weren't edited, it would just be a nightmare. You know, every segment that we do is double the length, sometimes triple the length of what it ends up being on air. And some never make it, because sometimes people who write books or sometimes people who cook food, they're not very, engaging. Or, you know, sometimes it's just not a great interview and we can't air it. And I so want to consume some of these podcasts that are being put together by younger people of a way different worldview than me, because my whole life is just about learning and empathy and wanting to be in, you know, internalize as many narratives as I can. But it's really hard for me to get through the content because it's just horrifying, you know, because especially at the beginning, you just are so excited about what you're doing that you just want to talk. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have somebody to take the time to edit your work, somebody who's not you, you know, which would be the perfect way, or even you on a different day, it just is never going to be of any quality.
I don't have time to listen to podcasts. So
Aren't you in traffic? Podcasts are saved my life in Los Angeles.
I'm actually driving kids in the morning to school, and they keep me quite busy. But it's interesting that you mentioned blogs, because, you know, blogs were the incubator for us to develop certain things. And I think that podcasts now, I mean, I have friends that used to run, you know, entire development divisions at big studios, and now they have their own podcast studios because they know that they could possibly develop these into shows, which is happening. I think you have the LA Times crime, what is his name? Right. And there are a couple of crime things that have happened.
So many crime. Yeah. Those are the ones I listen to.
So I think that a lot of people want to get into that excitement of, well, maybe I, in a low cost, I'll put something out there. Maybe it will turn into something else. I don't know.
But in the end, it's all writing. In the end, good podcasts are written first. There's a script that then is edited. And then, I mean, like Phoebe Judge, she just doesn't sit in front of a microphone and tell those criminal stories. Those are, you know, she must slave over every one of those scripts. I love her.
I think there's a lot to learn in, you know, applying the values of structured writing and editing, even in documentary. I mean, even with, like, everybody is entering the documentary world too, with like Netflix and Amazon pouring, you know, billions of dollars in original content. And there's also just a lot of just crap being funded. But I think you could apply those same ideals and values even within documentary. Like, for example, with us, we have a rigorous scripting process. And I'm hesitant to even say scripting because you're dealing with reality. Documentary should be more about, you know, what is happening, and it's not necessarily scripted. But we do have a process where we transcribe every single interview, and then we create a script out of those interviews and find the right narratives and the right themes. So I totally agree with like having that sort of value and intention, and putting writing at a much higher pedestal than what it might normally be considered.
So to me, the conundrum, the challenge is, how do we create collaborations or ateliers, guilds, where there is a process for a young person or a person who wants to learn a new trade, that's a media trade, and bring them in and mentor them and then create jobs. I mean, nobody can do this for free forever. It's fine if you're in your 20s. I mean, not even really. But, you know, you need to have a job.
I think the Evan Kleinman Writing Foundation needs to start right now.
Yeah, right. No, but I do think about, because I teach at UCLA now. I teach a food studies class, and I think about how I wish universities, I wish institutions that are so detached from the actual world of working and jobs would have centers in which they could collaborate with media institutions in a more robust way. Perhaps that will be the way of the future.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think I look at a lot of our content creative team, and they're all started as interns, or the majority of them. You know, it was just a process of learning the craft, of committing to it. And I mean, it's sort of a beautiful thing. And the reality is that a lot of those opportunities came from partnerships with the universities, a lot of the time. And they're, or not universities, it could be colleges or...
teaching institutions.
There you go.
I mean, I do think a lot of those internships have gone by the wayside, though. I know a lot in like Condé Nast has a policy now, like you cannot really be an intern unless it's for credit or, you know, we pay our interns because there have been lawsuits, you know, where people have felt like they've been abused. And I don't doubt that they were in some way. I feel like the mentors are going by the wayside because they have too much to do. But also people coming out of college have expectations of some sort of salary too. Like I remember I got paid my first job. They were like, why don't you work for us for 2 weeks as a test for free? And I was like, okay.
That's how I started in the kitchen. I mean, you know, I graduated from college. I got a BA and MBA. And then I just, you know, wanted to cook. So I went to a restaurant and I said, I'll work for you for 2 weeks for free. And then if you want me, you can pay me, you know?
It's difficult to do that these days, especially in New York. Now everything's so much more expensive. But I do feel like the system has changed. So there are a lot less opportunities for young people to come up and be mentored by someone. It's just, I don't know if it's financially possible anymore for a lot of companies.
And when you think about all the writers that have been in the magazine world for the last 40 years who are now retired.
Yeah, or they're being pushed out.
Or they're being pushed out. I mean, what a brain trust that is. Just a pool of gigantic intellect just sitting there. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm such a downer.
Well, let's chat about serious issues. We're going to get real serious now. So the Me Too movement has forced a lot of serious conversations and tough conversations to be had in all industries. And recently, the restaurant industry has been under fire. has this new movement and this news of, you know, sexual allegations and harassment, has that changed the way you report or your editorial mission within KCT, within Good Food, and Cherry Bomb? I mean, with Cherry Bomb, you guys launched a campaign called 86 This, and quote, a conversation about harassment, gender, and moving forward, and which was primarily all digital content, right?
Yeah, I just went from being like, we're not online, to, yeah, we did this thing. Right now, it's just a one-off, but we did that in response to everyone who emailed us, because we had April Bloomfield on the cover when the Ken Friedman story broke, and April got a lot of backlash for not doing enough. I think that, like, my partner and I, coming from a world of fashion, not having a background in food, neither of us have really worked in restaurants in the New York scene at all. It kind of gave us some sort of, like, protection from that, but when the whole Ken Friedman story broke, we were just like, So actually, that was a response to just wanting to open a forum for people to talk about their experiences. And it was amazing. We just posted an open call. Anyone could submit their stories. We basically said yes to everyone. And it was a lot of new writers and new people that we'd never worked with. And some of the stories were, like, a lot of the stories were very powerful. Oh, thank you. But how is it affecting us going forward? I think that it's pretty evident the next issue's theme is going to be home cooks. We're going to get out of the restaurant world for a little bit and just do stuff that hopefully is just feels good. And we'll see what happens with the whole shakeup around Me Too. It's happening in every industry. Hopefully, you know, it'll make the world a better place.
So interesting. I was going to ask you when you were going to do an issue of Home Cooks.
There you go. You want to pitch us?
I don't have time. Maybe I should. And for us, I just think for me, it's we're like gatekeepers, right? So it's like, who do you have on the show? Who do you interview, and then what do the shows look like? And you become really aware that when you're focusing on chefs, it's really easy to be white and male. And so I think it's just now we're more intentional and more saying, no, we don't need to tell that story. That story's been told a million times. Let's try and find this other story that hasn't been told so many times. And also, I just think that it's true that the demographics is different. I mean, I grew up in LA. I was born here. I mean, the way all of us who work on Good Food see the world is these multiplicity of stories. And I think for a while, it's easy to have been sucked into the bro sort of worldview of food. And I think that's just now blown up and good riddance. And I'm really happy that that's gone.
So am I.
When the elections happened, I remember that Monday, we always have like a morning editorial meeting, first on the digital side, then on the production side. And everybody was sort of fired up about, you know, we need to do this, and we need to write this, and we need to do that, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that was the first sort of feeling was we need to react to what is going on, you know. And it's not only the Me Too movement, it's a lot of other things. I mean, we have the gun issue going on right now. We have, you know, the Black Lives Matters. We have a lot of things going on in our society right now that, you know, when President-elect Trump came to office, he was, you know, they became sort of right in front of you, right? But the first instinct that people had was to react. We need to just counteract everything that is going on. Counteract the narrative of Trump and of, you know, the Republican Party. And that's what our storytelling needs to be about. I was very conflicted running the entire team. I was, because there was a part of me that was like, yeah, let's go for that. But after a couple of days and the following week, I realized that really the best thing that we can do, the political act that we can do, is actually not do that, right? And be extremely intentional about everything that we do, be it music, food, history. You know, we have shows about Native American traditional ecological knowledge. We have shows about the history of Los Angeles before the arrival of Anglos to LA. We have, and those are not consciously made to react against something. They're just stories that we need to tell. And that has been the editorial sort of role that we have taken. And I think it's fresh. It's not based on pundits and opinions, but on communities. And we're sort of proud of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what this whole movement is about, is giving voices to people that haven't been heard before. And honestly, like, I don't think any of us have an answer to what's next. It's just we're going to keep doing what we do and stand by what we stand by. And hopefully that will change the mindset, of, like change culture in a way, you know? It's just been trapped in that kind of too hierarchical, like, you know, there are people in power, but, you know, we're trying to give voices to everyone.
You know, and the thing is that if you look at our, when is the new census? Again, I forget, it's in, come on, this room needs to know when the new census, 2020. That's when everything is going to change. You know, you're going to have a completely new group of people that are active and voting, and they're very diverse, politically very, you know, different-minded than those who can vote today. And I think that that's going to be a determining factor of how we're going to move forward.
Yeah, I mean, and I also think that, I mean, talking about food, I know that for me, opening my first cookbook that I like, the very first cookbook that I became aware of consciously when I was young was a neighbor who was from Boston, had one of these old Boston cookbooks. So as an assimilated Jewish girl raised in Silver Lake, that to me was a completely different culture. And I became hooked on reading about food in cookbooks because I understood, even at like 8, 9 years old, that it was a way for me to see a window into a larger world. And I think it's what food does so well. You don't have to be political, because all you have to do is just let individuals tell stories. You know, I remember when I was at film school at UCLA, that my goal then, my dream was to pick a random person on the street and do one documentary a year just on that person. And so at the end of my life, I would have like 60 stories or whatever. But I feel like this is what great food media is doing now, is just telling all of these individual stories. And it's sort of like this chorus that maybe will drown out the other chorus, which seems to just have one note.
I want to get through just a couple more questions, and then I want to open up to the rest of you guys if you have any questions. Evan, specifically with you, I mean, you have interviewed over 6,000 guests.
Well, yeah, I think I figured out I've done about 6,000 interviews. Some of them have been multiple times.
Okay. You know, from chefs to local farmers, you clearly know how to talk to people in ways that, you know, they were able to open up and, you know, offer up that sort of journalistic goal to get some information out of them that is intimate and personal and valuable for listeners. And I ask this selfishly, but what makes a good interviewer? Show me your ways.
Okay, well, first of all, I have segment producers. I don't prepare the segments by myself. I have people whose job it is to read the same material I'm reading and to come up with questions, besides my own questions, because they have a different mind than I have, and they're different ages. We're right now the team is a panoply of ages. So we cover many generations, many decades, which is awesome because it means that the questions themselves can be of more than one mind. But I think what I learned early on when I finally got comfortable with the process is the best thing I could do is be really prepared. So I actually read everything. If it's a book, I read the book. If I don't have time to read the entire book, and it's like a textbook, I read the first few chapters, the last few chapters, and random chapters or parts of chapters in the middle. If there are magazine articles or newspaper articles, reviews about the book or the person, I read those. If there are videos, I watch those. One thing I tend not to do is listen to other radio interviews because I don't want to parrot what somebody else is doing. So when I sit in that room and I'm listening to somebody, I am really prepared. I know what they have to offer. The other thing I will say is I would say 90% of the time the person isn't in the room with me. We're either doing it through an ISDN line from another studio or we're using a voice memo. They're just doing it on they're recording their side of the conversation on their phone. So you, at least in my business, you become very aware that the entire room is a giant ear, and your job really is to just be ears, listen, and quiet yourself. And that's the hardest thing. When I first started, I would have all these questions in front of me, and then somebody would answer a question, and it would take the conversation somewhere else, and I didn't know what to do. I would look down at those questions. And I'd be like, but the next question doesn't fit. And then finally I understood that if I was really prepared, that all I had to do was listen and engage. And then but that's hard, you know? And I still get very nervous. I still get nervous before most interviews, especially if it's a subject that I care about and that a writer, like, for example, I don't know how many of you read that incredible piece on the Resniks, on the wonderful company that was in California Sunday, Mark Arocks. I mean, if you're going to read one agricultural article in the year, you must read. It's a 54-page article. It was written, the writing was just so beautiful, and it was this vast topic about water. And I was so nervous. But then, you know, we start talking, and this guy is such an incredible storyteller. Or the other day, it was an interview of the kind that's just more sort of poppy, and it was about booze and vinyl. So this pair of siblings who love pairing booze and vinyl. And so they had come to the interview, which was in another city, with their portable record player and vinyl. And we didn't know that in advance. And I just said, well, can you just drop the needle on something and then tell me? And it completely changed what the interview would have been if they hadn't done that, but I was open enough in the moment to ask them if they could do that. So being present and being a listener is really, really important, which is why I talk so much when I'm given this opportunity. Because I'm always listening to other people.
Juan, one thing I wanted to ask you, and we've chatted about this before, you know, with so many different brands and networks pouring billions of dollars in original programming and billion-dollar networks with fierce competition, lots of budgets, big budgets, yet you remain and champion public broadcasting, which ultimately serves Southern California through KCET. Why has that been important to you?
When I was, I was very lucky to study film in Boston at Emerson College. And I lived in a neighborhood called the South End. I don't know if anybody knows that neighborhood. But back then, the South End was really, it was a tough neighborhood. This was 1990, maybe. Dude, that's a long time ago. Wow.
Not really.
Well, not really. But it was a Puerto Rican and a Dominican neighborhood. And I lived in below the brownstones in one of those underground apartments. And, you know, there were always these kids, these Puerto Rican kids and these Dominican kids that would see me come with tripods and cameras and things like that. And I was sort of friends with them. And one day they asked me what I was doing. And I told them that I was studying film. And they said that they wanted to do a film. And I said, well, it takes a lot of time mentoring. It takes a lot of work to do a film. If you guys want to do a film, then we need to write it. We need to storyboard it. We need to do all this. And they were like, we're cool. And these were like 10, 11-year-old kids. And we did the film, and they wrote this film, and it was about this two group of dancers that get into a dancing fight and whatever. And we shot in Boston Commons and things like that. But that experience was so, you know, looking back, like almost 30 years back, was so influential for me because it really let me see the connection between representation and community. And, you know, the power that both giving the tools to our community to represent themselves and, you know, sort of engaging them was just huge. And when I came here to, you know, be sort of an indie filmmaker or whatever, I did not find any of that. And the only place that I really found it was in public television. So
my very first media job was at KCET.
Really?
Yeah, when they used to do those on-air auctions, yeah. I was a talent coordinator. I would have to call up all these celebrities, agents, cold, and beg them to come on the air and answer telephones.
We don't do that anymore.
I know. I still have some products in my home, though, from those.
I want to give a chance to you guys, if there's any question you want to ask to Claudia, Evan, or Juan, to the audience. Anybody have a question?
So, Evan, you were very passionate about a structureless or not having a structureless environment and mentorship. So do you feel like with that, it's a structureless landscape, and because it's kind of chaotic and overwhelming, especially like when you have a stack full of stories you want to read, what do you think really, what factors does it take to really make an impact in a food story or a culinary story culturally? Like,
wow, what a huge question. That's a really good question. It is a really good question, and it has so many different answers because everything is just stories, right? Everything is just individuals telling a story, whether or not it's about themselves or something they see or a technique, you know. I hate the word authentic because I think it's so problematic. But when you're reading things or somebody's pitching to you, you know what is something that has a kernel of something that's real. I mean, for me, a lot of it is, what do I want to learn that either I haven't already learned, which at my age is still considerable, or something that maybe is a story we've done over the 20-year life of Good Food many times before, but brings the now. How is that story being told now? And who's telling the story and what do they have to share? It's so subjective, it's really hard to parse that out. But almost everything that comes to me is edited already. I mean, they're books have been edited, they're, you know, films, shows. So I'm not seeing raw material like Claudia would or Juan would. I don't know, how would you answer that question?
I don't know. I mean, I think when we first started Cherry Bomb, we just kind of did it very blindly. But I think that you're not a unique snowflake. Like, you can like apples, and you'll be sure to find someone else that likes apples, too. So for us, it was always about creating a product that we would read ourselves. And we just hoped that someone else would want to read it too. I don't think we were trying to do anything groundbreaking or culturally, you know, shift the culture.
But I don't know. Just the fact that you staked out this niche that no one had done. I mean, that was pretty radical.
In our minds, it wasn't that radical. I think also at the time, it was more of a reaction to what was out there already, right? So you have like the Lucky Peaches of the world. And we're like, we're going to take the girl side because we love food. We love reading about food. But we just didn't feel like there was a voice for the girls, you know? I think that was just what we did. We didn't really consider it so groundbreaking or so revolutionary. We just were like, well, you know, let's talk about other stuff in a different voice.
Also, I should say is in the life of Good Food, I've gone through 6 producers, 6, you know, like executive or supervising producers, and each one of those people have brought who they are to the show. And they've been very different. I mean, clearly very different people. With a different background, interested in very different things. And I'm always grateful for that because it gives me an opportunity to shift my point of view and be fed. Because if I weren't fed new things after all this time, I mean, how could I keep doing it? It's 20 years of talking about food.
All right. Guys, thank you so much for coming by. I want to thank Juan Davis, Evan, and Claudia for making the time and joining us.
Many thanks to Life and Time for putting together such a terrific event. Now for my conversation with Food Book Fair co-directors Kimberly Chow and Amanda Dell. I was thrilled to talk to them about how they got involved with the fair, as well as their careers in food media.
Hi, ladies.
Hello, hello. We're really happy to be talking to you as well.
So when did it start? How long ago?
It started in 2012, actually, and it was started by a woman named Elizabeth Thacker Jones, and it was one of the very first events at the new Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
And what was the idea? It just seems like there's been a proliferation of different kinds of gatherings with food at the center. What was the mission and the drive to do it?
Yeah, so when Elizabeth started it, she was a graduate student at New York University in the Food Studies program. And Food Book Fair is sort of the master's thesis that took off and took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
In 2012, she was particularly inspired by bringing people together for an event that would bridge conversations about food systems and conversations about food culture. And there wasn't really anything like that at the time. There were conferences that were more academic. There were festivals that were about pleasure and consumption. And there wasn't really anything that brought people together to talk about or break bread over these conversations and celebrate also the publications that were coming out. Around the early 2010s, there were a lot of food magazines,
right.
Independent food magazines that were really exciting. A lot of them based in Brooklyn. Diner Journal, Put an Egg on It, Gather Journal. Some of them are still around today.
Yeah.
And one of the signature events Elizabeth started then, which is now also taken on a life of its own, is called Foodiotticals. Yeah. That's food plus periodicals. Lots of vowels. It's a word that Eater.com banned in 2012, and it's the thing that keeps us going.
Yeah.
Amanda will talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, because I have to say I'm really fascinated by the growth of that part. You know, in the old days, they were like zines,
yeah.
where they were like super DIY.
Mm-hmm.
And this new generation are much more polished, but have very, very specific focus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are so incredibly inspired by all of the independent food magazines that we get to work with and that we are able to, you know, provide some sort of other platform for them to maybe get new readers and new audience. And really, the editors and makers behind them are so creative. And it is such a pleasure to be able to leaf through a magazine. And I think other people are also sharing that and are also maybe wanting to take a break from staring at their screen and getting to just enjoy something that is visual as well.
Also, I have to say what I love about it is if you're only going to get your information off the internet, if you're only going to browse for books or magazines or content, you're already in this niche zone. So you're sort of like in this self-fulfilling feedback loop. And when you're somewhere physical, like a bookstore or at a fair like this one, and you get to walk around and browse and see covers, the way you discover things is different.
Yeah, definitely. It's based on the bookshop choosing to place two magazines next to each other or a book next to a zine that you maybe haven't heard of before. We do that in the way we convene Foodieoticals and the rest of Food Book Fair. And that's something that brings us great delight and great joy. And that's definitely part of what drives the thing.
Yeah. And going back to just growing up and even magazines that weren't food related, like a magazine like Sassy Magazine, that will always be something in my mind. And I have issues that I have saved and it and just various columns that, you know, they created themselves that spoke to me in a certain way, and seeing musicians or, you know, film actresses in the magazine was just so, it just really spoke to me. And I always grew up reading magazines.
So beyond the magazine scene, do you see the Food Book Fair as being a place to highlight sort of these indie food voices, like podcasters, different social media personalities as well?
Sure. We love to do that. And that's a huge part of our mission. We also, it's, you know, exciting to include well-known, you know, chefs and writers as well. But it's also, very, very important to our mission to be able to hold space for those that, as you mentioned in our panel earlier, and others have mentioned, that haven't had, you know, as much of the spotlight shined on them and that are doing incredible work.
Yeah, and definitely at the beginning of Food Book Fair when it started, and Amanda and I started working on it a few years into the fair, and that as event producers, and then a couple years after we both started working on it in 2016, that was the first fair that we sort of ran under our own names, and we took it over as co-directors under our own business. It's always been, Food Book Fair has always been about highlighting independent indie makers and voices that are not represented as well in mainstream media. And especially for us, it is about saying explicitly who we're talking about. And that's often folks of color, queer folks, women of color that are not represented as well in mainstream media. I think that's changing. But having that as one of the driving factors behind what we do and why we create and hold space for folks, that is definitely something that speaks to us personally and one of the reasons why we're here.
And also, the people that haven't gotten a chance to tell their stories are often have the most fascinating stories. And that's what we really want to dig into.
Briefly, could each of you tell me how you sort of found food as your focus?
Yeah. Amanda, do you want to go first?
Certainly. I actually came into media from a little bit of a roundabout way, which was that I actually worked in restaurants, and I was a maitre d' for a long time, and it was part of my job to know who people were. And you didn't want your chef to come out into the dining room and say, well, hey, is that Evan Kleiman sitting there at, you know, table 101? No, it was your job to know who that was. So I spent a lot of time stalking, New York Times reviewers like Frank Bruni and Sam Sifton, and making sure I knew who they were. And I loved consuming media. And I had an interest in food and restaurants and hospitality. So I kind of came, I saw Food Book Fair as an event. And I was like, wow, this combines so many of the things I love. How can I work on it? How can I be a part of it? That's kind of my story.
And you, Kimberly?
My background is in journalism. I worked in newspapers and magazines and online publications for several years during and after college. Worked at the Wall Street Journal. I worked at MSN.com for a while. I worked in various departments, but I mostly wrote about art and culture. And food was something, making and sharing food and convening around it was something that I grew up with. And even though making and sharing and convening around food was something that I grew up with. And when I was in New York as a young person, I had a lot of friends that were in and around the restaurant industry. And I was laid off from my last mainstream media job. And I met Elizabeth, who had started Food Book Fair. And she said, "You can do event production, right?" And I said, "Sure." And she asked me to produce Foodiotticals. And I said, "It's all these magazines and it's just, you know, bringing people together. How hard could that be?" And then I got sucked into it. And it's brought me, so I got sucked into that. And I just started doing more and more. And I think one of the great appeals about it was I was an editorial assistant, I was a reporter, I was a fact checker, I was a copy reader. I did all these things, even when it involved reporting or doing interviews in the field or with people in person. I would go home at the end of the day or go back to my desk at the office, and I was right behind a computer. And I spent a lot of time on the phone or with my voice recorder. And being able to sort of tell a story in real life or in real time and bring people together was such a revelation. And that's what was so great about doing a public event. And that's something that Amanda and I have talked a lot about.
Is this foray to LA your first time out of Brooklyn with the fair?
This is our first time out of New York. We did the first Food Book Fair in partnership with Ace Hotel New York last year in May 2017. And after that, we started having a conversation about bringing it to Ace Hotel downtown Los Angeles. And also, but also from afar, we've been admiring all of the conversation and the publications and the restaurants and the energy coming out of Los Angeles.
Really surprised me. We're thrilled to be here.
Thanks to both of you. Thank you for bringing it out here. It's the programming is really fantastic.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this bonus episode of Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I've been sharing highlights from Food Book Fair LA earlier this month. Our thanks to Kimberly Chow and Amanda Dell at Food Book Fair for allowing us to share these segments. Be sure to check your podcatchers for part two next Monday, April 2nd, when we'll be sharing two great panels on freelancing and food media and the explosion of Asian food in America. See you next week. And as always, thanks for listening to Good Food.